Well, you know, actually, my background is not in academic research. The strand of curiosity comes from my childhood when I was growing up in Japan, and I went to St. Mary's Military Academy, a Catholic school that studied Jesus and the Gospels, of course. And I was fell away from the faith, no particular reason. I just, as I got older, it didn't appeal to me. And the curiosity about it, though, particularly the character Jesus, remained. And when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, or actually were publicized to the extent that I became aware of them, I started reading about them, and that's really what sort of began this the research that ended up with Caesar's Messiah. It was just shocking to me to find out that there had been a messianic movement in Judea during this era that was militaristic. And because it's such a small region, it just didn't make any sense to me how you could have two diametrically opposed messianic movements in the same territory. And it was also curious as to why this hadn't been mentioned in the Gospels. You see, they don't mention the fact that Rome is waging this 135-year war against this messianic movement during the entire period in which Jesus was supposedly alive. So that seemed very suspicious to me, and I started to read the Gospels again. I hadn't looked at them in 50 years, but I started reading them. I was curious about this, and I realized I needed to have some kind of basis of information to vet what is historical in the Gospels, and that meant studying Flavius Josephus, because he's the only historian of this era that exists. So I was reading the works of Josephus, and I started to notice that there were very oddball type relationships between what Josephus was writing about in the war. He was writing primarily about the war that occurred between 66 and 73 in the first century, between Rome and the Messianic movement. But I started noticing these odd relationships between what he was writing about and stories in the Gospels. And so I started to basically try to make sense of these parallels. I was curious as to, well, was Josephus influenced by the Gospels, or were the Gospels influenced by Josephus? I was really trying to answer that kind of, directional question. And then one day I had was basically studying like maybe a dozen of them that I was curious about, and I noticed something that was just quite amazing to me, which is that all of them occurred in the same sequence. So in other words, these parallels that I had noticed and were studying between Josephus's account of the war and Jesus's ministry, they all occurred in the same sequence. And so at that point, I wondered, well, really, how far did the sequence go? And I started comparing the whole war against the whole ministry, and then realized that the entire ministry of Jesus was written basically based upon the military campaign of Titus Flavius. That if you start at the Sea of Galilee, where Jesus gathers his disciples together and he says, "Follow me, become fishers of men," and then just trace his entire ministry all the way to the end, where he basically condemns Simon and spares John, that all of these events, or most of them, can be plugged into the account of the war that Josephus wrote, and they're all occurring in the same sequence. So I then, realized that there would have been a purpose for this. It wasn't just accidental. And so that was when I started studying basically the genres of literature that I, trying to see, well, what am I dealing with? What is the basis for all this? And I noticed the typologic sequence in Matthew at the very beginning, which links Jesus to Moses. And I won't go into all of it, but it's well known to scholars. It's not something that I discovered. It's a very well vetted and understood piece of what's called typology. In other words, Jesus is created as a type of Moses. All of these events where Jesus goes into the wilderness and he's tempted by the devil and he has his baptism before this, these are all representations of Jesus as a type of Moses. He is basically the author of Matthew is suggesting that Moses was the basis. There was a kind of a divine connection between Jesus and Moses. And so to create that typology, the author of Matthew used names, locations, concepts, and he arranged them in the same sequence. So in other words, the events in Matthew occur at the same sequence that they're given in the Old Testament that they were drawn from. And so then I could see exactly what had happened at this point, that someone had written the Gospels basically to have this hidden level of it, which showed that that Jesus had basically been a type of this Roman Caesar. And this may, you know, seem a little oddball to listeners, but if you read the Gospels, you'll see that there's really a strange illogic to them, in that Jesus is supposed to be divine and the Son of God, but very often he references someone who's going to come in the future. He calls this individual the Son of Man, which is a messianic title. It means the Jewish Messiah, basically. And so he says he's going to come, and then he describes when he's going to come. He says he's going to come before this generation passes away, but he's going to come at the time when the temple is going to be raised and Jerusalem will be encircled, and there'll all be this apocalyptic series of events. So the question is, well, why would Jesus, since this individual was not Jesus, he did not, at least according to history, return and you know, be available during the war, because these events are clearly from the Jewish-Roman War, which would occur in 40 years from Jesus's ministry. Since Jesus did not come back, why would the author of these words be indicating that this individual called the Son of Man would be returning in 40 years and accompanied by all this apocalyptic material? Well, once you understand that Jesus is a type of the Roman Caesar Titus Flavius, you can see the point. I mean, basically, the author of the gospel is simply indicating that the Son of Man, who is going to come accompanied by all of these apocalyptic militaristic events, is the Roman Caesar. While this may seem far-fetched to your listeners, I would point out that this was common. This was a very common perspective in the Roman imperial court, that the Caesars were the Jewish Messiah. And in fact, Josephus, Tacitus, Suetonius, Dio, all of the Flavian court historians maintained this position, that the messianic prophecies, which the Jews believed foresaw a Jew, someone who would be the Jewish military leader a la David, the original Messiah, who had this power of God and would thereby enable the Jews to resist the Roman colonization, that all of the Roman historians said, no, they were wrong. It wasn't a Jew. It was the Flavian Caesar that all of these prophecies had envisioned. And so the fact is that the Gospels are very illogical and incoherent if you read them as a historical piece, just as they are. But if you read them as a typological foreseeing of the military campaign and the Son of Man is basically the Roman Caesar, all of this mystery just disappears and the Gospels make perfect sense. In fact, you could take all of these apocalyptic events and simply switch the name, the Son of Man, which is the title given in the Gospels, with the name Titus Flavius, and they would make perfect sense. The Gospels would make absolutely perfect sense, because Titus achieved all of these military victories that Jesus envisioned.
Okay, so what is the overall summary of what you came up with in like two sentences?
The Gospels are written by the Flavians, and the victors write history. The Gospels are an example of that, but here the victors wrote it as a prophecy.
And you used, now what documents? You used the historical documents written by Josephus.
You really only need the Gospels and the history of Josephus. Those are the only components of the entire puzzle. And what you do is, if you read Caesar Messiah, what do you see I do in what's called the Flavian Signature? I don't do any flipping around, or, you know, which is possible to do, but people sometimes would criticize this. So I just said, okay, fine. I just take the Gospel of Luke and I lay it out Right. I take the events in the Gospel of Luke and I lay next to them the military campaign that Josephus is writing about. And I just put them out in sequence, right? So you have like 40, more than 40 of these parallels. They are in, I give them in the exact sequence that they appear in Josephus and in the exact sequence they appear in the Gospel of Luke. And I just say, look, here it is. This relationship cannot be accidental. Many of the parallels in this sequence are completely self-evident. I mean, Jesus says that, you know, Jerusalem's going to be encircled. Josephus records that Titus encircles Jerusalem. Jesus says the temple's going to be raised. The temple complex will be raised, not one stone atop another. Titus raises the temple complex. I mean, there are all of these kinds of just completely verbatim, no contestation possible kind of parallels. And then in between them, then there's some that are like more puzzling. They're like you have to kind of scratch your head a bit to see the relationships. But there are enough that are just completely no-brainer that any kind of normal person can see that Jesus's ministry is completely developed from the military campaign. And, you know, like people always ask me, they go, well, is Jesus a historical character? And I always say, I know this may seem weird, but that's not the right question. You know, if the creator of Donald Duck had a duck who lived next to him as a pet whose name was Donald, is the character he developed based on the named duck a historical character or is a cartoon character? This is a semantical question, right? It's not really one that can be answered to any, you know, completion. But what you can say is that, well, he was creating a cartoon. Cartoon is a fictional genre. That's really the question that people should ask about the Gospels, is not, you know, was this individual, is there any possible way that there was a historical individual that could have been used in some way in the creation of this character? What you really want to ask is, what is the genre that the authors are producing? And when you realize it's typology, that everything in Jesus's ministry and his pre-ministry are all based on other stories, then you can say with complete, you know, certainty that it's not a historical genre. So Jesus is not a historical character. It's a fictional genre. It's a typologic, you know, exposition and typology is 100% of the time fiction. That's the only way that that genre can be created. It's based on another story. So the story that's being told is not, you know, a way of describing something that occurred. It's a way of representing a prior story.
Well, let's look at some of the things that I've seen that you've stated. You state that you believe the Flavians actually wrote the Gospels, but that's when Christianity ended, you said. So what do you believe Christianity was before that point? And who are the Flavians and what do we have now? You know, let's start with what was Christianity and why do you think it ended at that point? And then get into who the Flavians were.
Well, what I mean is that the Messianic movement was not destroyed. There was a real Messianic movement, and it produced the literature that we know of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and it's militaristic, right? So this is the version of Messianic Judaism that was in existence in reality in the first century. The Flavians conquered this religious military organization and drove them out of Judea. So at that point, the religion didn't exist any longer inside of Judea. You had the diaspora where Jews were banned from being in the region from 135 onward. And so that would be, you know, the basis for the claim that the religion ended. The real Christianity was no longer in Judea. The Flavians were the family that came to the throne after the Julio-Claudians. The famous Caesars, Nero, Julius, Augustus, they were of the family that's known as the Julio-Claudians. In 69, Vespasian, who was Titus Flavius' father, basically seized the throne. The idea was is that the Julio-Claudians had become decadent. You know, you have Caligula and Nero. These are kind of quasi-poetic types that are, you know, according to the Flavians, weren't really capable of running the empire. Vespasian and Titus were military men. They had been the 10 years prior to the Judean rebellion, they had been in Gaul and Brittany putting down the Druid rebellions. So they were just 100% military men. When the Jewish rebellion broke out in 66, it was a very serious situation. They actually drove the Roman legions out of Judea and set up a nation state right in the middle of the Roman Empire. Now, this couldn't be abided by from Rome, because at this point the Roman Empire was a prison of nations, basically. They had conquered all sorts of ethnicities and nations and held them in control, you know, vis-a-vis their military force. So they couldn't let this nation state remain in existence. Nero, he at that point contacted Vespasian, who was presumably his very best military general, and said, go down to Judea and put the rebellion down. And Vespasian did, but midway or at a point through the war, events in Rome, Nero died. There was other Julio Claudians that tried to take the throne, but Vespasian returned, and he, since he had more, basically more influence with the military, Roman military, he became the Caesar. And so you now have the Flavians replacing the Julio Claudians. The question that often comes up is, well, how could they possibly have written the Gospels? How could the Flavians, who are Roman military men, write something that was so specifically Hebraic as the Gospels? If you look at the Gospels, there's just page after page of, you know, kind of this complicated typology relating back to the Old Testament. Well, in fact, the Flavians were allied with two families, and these were the tax collectors of Judea and Egypt, the Herods and the Alexanders. Titus lived with Bernice, who was Herod the Great's niece. She was a, you know, from the family of Herod. They were the Rome's tax collector of the area of Judea. And the Flavians had the Alexanders as allies. Tiberius Alexander was the general who actually oversaw their army when Vespasian went back to Rome. So these two families who were Jewish, you see, this is the key point. The Alexanders, Tiberius's uncle, was Philo, the famous Jewish intellectual, probably the most famous intellectual of the Jewish language of this whole era. He was the uncle of Tiberius. And so you can see that the family, the Flavians, had inside their inner circle, and these are it's the closest associations that they are known to have, the mistress of Titus, the general who was leading the army. These families were Jewish tax collectors. They were completely opposed to the Messianic movements because they were interfering with their income. You see, the Messianic movement was basically destructive to their financial interests. So they allied themselves with the Flavians against them. And then following the war, the Messianic movement hadn't been extinguished because basically it comes right from the Jewish religion. You know, if you look at the Torah, you see all these examples where God intercedes on the behalf of the Jewish people. I mean, David is given this miraculous power. And so following the war, they decided that they wanted a version of Judaism that basically was not so impossible to accept the Roman Empire and be a colony. And so this was one of the bases to create Christianity, was just the political basis to have a toned down version of Messianic Judaism, where in the Messiah would say, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, turn the other cheek. You know, you had this pacifist pro-Roman message in this literature, which you, if you contrast this with the Dead Sea Scrolls, the actual literature of the Messianic movement, what you see there is, you know, the logical aspect of the Jewish religion in relationship to colonialization, which is to say it was militaristic. It was saying, you know, we're going to organize and kill the invaders, you see. So it was, this literature was very important in bringing about the rebellion.
Okay, so now the Dead Sea Scrolls was the Masonic movement. And how does that differ from what we... Now, you say it describes Christianity. back then. How does that differ from what the Jews believed back then versus Christianity versus what we have today for Christianity?
Yeah, I mean, well, today what we have with Christianity is a Roman religion, right? So it isn't in fact something that comes organically from Judaism. I
Yeah,
mean,
it was you bear that's the comment, thereby ending Christianity.
Yeah, that the real Christianity, which would have been the Christianity simply means the Messiah, the Jewish king who has a relationship to God. This is something that this concept occurs in the Torah, and it would be the way that a Jewish faithful would look at the world. It would be the worldview that someone who was a follower of the Torah and of the kind of Judaism in the Dead Sea Scrolls would have, that we will have a military solution, and we will be given the power of God to our king, and that this will then bring about our ability to defeat the Romans and to set up Israel again.
Well, now, was this different, the Messiah movement, different than Judaism? That
Yeah,
as described in the Dead
that's a
Sea
really good
Scroll.
question.
Yeah.
Really good question. I don't know. I mean, the thing is it kind of depends on what you mean. There was a kind of Judaism that I think was very heavily influenced by Rome even before you had the production of Christianity. So what happens is you have the Maccabees, right? This is the Hasmonean family. It's 166 BCE, before the year one. They see that there is a very secular kind of influence, that's occurring in Judea. This was, after Alexander the Great had conquered the region. You had one of his generals, Ptolemy and Seleucids, divided up some of the kingdom. One's in Egypt, one is in Judea, and you start this process of Hellenizing Jewish people. I talk about this in Caesar's Messiah, that there was this long period before the Maccabees where you had this strong Hellenizing influence. And the Maccabees then wanted to return the Jewish people to what they saw as a more fundamental kind of Judaism. So they basically seize control of Judea and they set up a religious state. So with the Maccabees, you had Eretz Israel. It's a religious state. It's all organized around the Jewish religion, and you don't have any kind of cosmopolitan or secular influence. You just have this fundamental religion. Now, this changes though because Rome basically took advantage of an inter-family squabble. Pompey was able to side with one of the Hasmoneans against another. They brought in the family of Herod as a kind of advisor. And then once they had this war, the civil war between the Hasmoneans cleared out, Rome never left, basically. And then the family of Herod became basically the tax collector, and they were running the region. So at this point, in terms of what is the real Judaism, it would just depend on who was answering the question.
Well, and what's the real Christianity? Because you were saying Christianity ended when the Flavians created this whole new Roman.
Well, I mean, again, it's just semantics. I mean, the thing is, if you abide with my interpretation, you see that the Messianic movement, right, is organic to Judaism. What Rome does is they create a new version of the religion. So we have what is now Christianity, we call Christianity, but it's a fake religion. So if you want to define the creation of Christianity as the end of the prior Messianic movement, then that would be the end of Christianity by that definition. But Christianity as religiously following a Christ, I mean, it's never ended. It's always been a religion in existence to one degree or another, because even after the Roman Jewish War, you had rabbinical Judaism be established. Now, this religion was very much at the beginning, and opposed to the Messiah. It didn't want the idea of the Messiah because it had led to all this disaster. So rabbinical Judaism, which was controlled by the Flavians, just like Christianity was, I mean, it starts in one of the Herod family compounds. That religion, I think, is also at its onset fake, and it's a Roman-controlled religion. I don't think that the Messiah would have been something that would have been promoted in any way by the beginnings of rabbinical Judaism. As far as anyone can tell from the writings, they were completely opposed to the concept and wanted it not on the table because it had led to this enormous disaster for the Jewish people. I mean, the rebellions lasted from the year 1 to 135. The accounts basically describe a bloodbath in the millions. And at the end of it, there's the diaspora, where the Jews are told they can't even occupy Judea any longer. So as the history is recounted, the rabbis, the people who are involved in instructing religion at this point, said, okay, that's enough. No more Messiah, no more Christianity. We're going to basically be something that can exist within the Roman Empire. They had a kind of Judaism which is very much different than the Hasmoneans would have had, or the Messianic movement, which I think sprang as a result of the Hasmoneans being deposed, how they would have seen it. But what you can see when you go through the history is that these things are basically dealer's choice. You have the history of the religion, you have the literature, and then you have political influence. And whatever political influence is on top makes the rules and then determines, well, what is the religion going to be like?
What did the Flavians really believe? Or if
I think
anything?
I would say they're among the most cynical people imaginable. On his deathbed, Vespasian supposedly looked up at his doctor and he said, "Oh my gosh, I'm becoming a god." And this is clearly a comment of irony and kind of sarcasm. You have to remember this is the era of the imperial cult, because when basically the Roman Caesar saw the political advantage of being gods or seen as being divine, makes people a lot easier to control. So the Roman Senate would deify Caesars that were seen as beneficial to the empire. So Vespasian and Titus were both deified. They both actually were made gods. Titus had his father deified. So when you talk about, the Flavian religious perspective, it's very political. It basically is trying to use religion as a propaganda device. If you travel around Italy, Rome, or any, Ephesus, you'll see enormous temples to the imperial cult. The Romans would have figures of themselves, 30 feet high and covered in gold leaf, and then they would have miracles ascribed to them. The Roman court historians would talk about Vespasian curing peoples of blindness by rubbing his spit on their eye, or if you have a withered hand, he could make it come back. So, their religious perspective, in my opinion, was completely political. All they cared about was power, the maintenance of power, the continuation of power, and religion was something that just fit into that formula. And so all religion was part of the Roman, basically bureaucracy.
I suppose it's not much different than North Korea right now, where they should say that he does all these miracles and is,
100%.
you
Yeah. I
know.
mean, in my opinion, it's whenever you get to a leader who suggests divinity, the people are in trouble. It's not a good sign, and that should be a red flag to everybody that there's a problem. And as you go forward, just to finish up this thought, Constantine, whose name is Flavius Constantine, may have been in the same family as the creators of Christianity. So at the beginning of the 4th century, he starts about the process to make Christianity the state religion. He also creates the feudal system at the same time. He starts the feudal system in operation. Now, the feudal system, you have the serf, a slave, you have a hierarchy, and the top of it, you have the Pontiff Maximus or Pope, right? This is the system that existed throughout the Dark Ages, 1500 years of this. The Pope, the title that the Pope had was Pontiff Maximus, to this day, Pontiff Maximus. Now, that's a title that the Roman Caesar had. This is where it comes from. It means the head of the Roman College of Priests, and it's simply one of the titles of Caesar. The Vatican is on the same territory that the Roman Caesars had their palaces. So you can see that there is this odd relationship between the feudal system and the Roman dictatorships by the Caesar. The main difference is you have Christianity, which promises a kind of workers' paradise after you're dead if you follow the Pope's instructions. So I think what's pretty clear what happened is they just gave the serf the idea that if they just followed the magistrate who was there because Jesus wanted him there, and everyone's role in life had been established by God and Jesus, and you simply should accept it. And if you obeyed and didn't rebel, then there would be a paradise waiting for you after your death. Again, it's just very cynical politics. This is just an easy way for the Caesars to control a prison of nation and individuals.
Okay, well, what was in the Dead Sea Scrolls? Because you never, there was this big fanfare about the Dead Sea Scrolls, and then it really died out.
Yeah. Well,
Was there story? Was Jesus in the Dead Sea Scrolls, or was there stories like Jesus? What was in there, and why has it been so quiet?
I don't really know why it's so quiet. There was quite a scandal about the scrolls. There was like 50 years from when they were discovered to when they were actually released to the public. It came about through a scholar named Robert Eisenman getting photo plates of the entire collection, and he released it to the public so that people could see what they consisted of, particularly the ones that hadn't been translated. And basically, the Dead Sea Scrolls are just very messianic. And as far as do they describe Jesus? Well, I mean, the character of Jesus Christ is just wildly implausible. There's no way he would ever be in any historical document, but they do describe an individual they call the righteous teacher. He's a messianic character. They say they describe a Messiah who will rule the heaven and earth. They look to this individual basically as a new David. I mean, this is what the Dead Sea Scroll shows, that there was a military response to colonialization. There was a religious military response, which is, of course, absolutely logical and to be expected from the followers of the basically religion that has David as this key historical person. They would look to a repeat of that, that relationship where their king or Messiah would have the power of God, and then they would be basically invincible and could drive Rome out. So that's what the scrolls show. The scrolls are very logical to the Jewish religion in the same way that the Gospels are completely illogical. I mean, they show basically someone claiming to be, a descendant of David as a pacifist. Well, I'm sorry, David wasn't a pacifist. David cut Goliath's head off. This was how David behaved. So the character in the Gospels is a political character. He was someone that Rome wanted to exist, and they just brought him to life as a kind of literary Hebraic cartoon that they hoped would basically be something they could fool people with.